thanks so much. This is going to make it really fun. There's a lot of awesome questions in here. Unfortunately, the 15 minutes that I was supposed to spend reading them and figuring out which ones, I just spent moving chairs. So this might be a little bit more random than I had hoped. But Katie has been so kind as to select the first question for us to get kicked off with. And of course, she will be the first panelist that I pick on to answer the question. So the question is, historically, have we ever discovered new physics from tensions between observations, or only from tensions between theory and observation?
Okay, so I guess the context of this is the Hubble tension, right? So you have these two different observations, or several different observations not agreeing about something. But I think that the tricky thing about a question like that is that no observation means anything without the context of a model. And so there are lots of examples where observations that we thought should give the same answer gave different answers, and that therefore we concluded that there was a problem, but that was because we had a model that said they should give the same answer, rather than the observations on their own. So the Hubble tension is, we have several different ways of measuring the expansion rate of the universe today, H naught, and you can do it by looking at the supernova recession based on the redshift and the distance that you estimate for the supernovae. That's a way to get the sort of a local measurement of the expansion rate. You could also use the properties of the cosmic microwave background to get some a measurement of H naught, in the sense that the sort of geometry of the cosmic microwave background is dependent on a number of equations where H naught is a sort of parameter, right? And so you can we expect that the H naught that we measure from the CMB and the H naught that we measure from these local measurements and things like lensing and a number of baryon acoustic oscillations, a number of different things, should be the same number, and we're getting different numbers with many sigma difference in that. And so that's the a sort of context in asking about, like, this is a difference in observations, and is that telling us something about new physics? And maybe it is. Maybe there's new physics in the early universe, or maybe there's new physics in the evolution of the universe that is explaining why we would get a different answer by looking at an early universe observation versus a late universe observation, when you should get the same answer. But that's all in the context of this model that says that those observations should give the same answer, that those observations have the same parameter embedded in the Friedman equations and so on. So it's not necessarily the fact that the observations are different, it's that in the context of the models, we expect these two kinds of observations to give the same answer, but it's still a question really of agreement between model and observation, and that's kind of always always the kind of testing we're doing in some sense. So there's other examples that I was thinking about in terms of discrepancies between observations, like the sort of K long, K short thing, and that's, these two different, the lifetimes of this particle should be the same in the context of the theory that says that they're the same, not without that context. Or even, the closest I could find to a pure two observations being different tell us something important is in the sense of, quantum mechanics, you do the same observation over and over again, you get different answers, and that's a purely, that's really, the observation is different, and that's telling you something deep about the theory. But you get different answers doing any experiment over and over again. There's just different reasons for the errors. So anyway, that's my thoughts about that. You really can't disentangle a model from observational data at any time, because they're always part of the same picture.
So I didn't properly introduce the panel. That was my mistake. This is Katie Mack, who is here at Perimeter Institute. We have Jonathan Braden, who is from CETA, University of Toronto. Rania Paris, who is visiting from University College London. And Latham Boyle, who is here at Perimeter Institute as well. OK, there we go. Louder. Wonderful. So Hubble tension and other tensions. We find these tensions in the data. So we are purporting to measure the same thing, but twice. So it's the same parameter we're measuring in two different ways.
In the context of the model that says it's the same parameter, yes.
In the context of the model that says it's the same parameter, right? Any other comments? Yeah, Bill.
History might give us a little bit of a guidance here. When I grew up in physics, was the time of the great the Vaucouleurs-Sandage debates. One of them got 100 kilometers per second per megaparsec. The other one got 50, and you know, I would attend these big conferences in which each of them would give a talk and defend to the death exactly their result. They were each within plus or minus 10%. These were the quoted errors that they gave you. And one of them, I remember in a talk, said, "And it would be a bad mistake to simply average our two results." Well, it turned out that the value that we have now is almost exactly the average of those two results. And so, you know, these are incredibly difficult measurements to make. And these stars don't simply line themselves up nicely as you would do in an experiment to give us, you know, the Hubble parameter. They don't have little signs on them saying, "I am now at, you know, 500 megaparsecs or whatever, you know, and here's my frequency." So, you know, I think some of these tensions one should take with a grain of salt and just wait.
Sure, sure. Yeah, so let me pick on, Hiranya, you want to comment?
I would like to add to this point that, you know, currently our error bars on the two probes that Katie was talking about are at the 1.5 to 2% precision. So there's a difference between precision and accuracy, of course. And neither of them are actually direct measurements. One is a more indirect measurement. You make a measurement in the early universe, and you use a model to kind of forward simulate it to the late universe and predict the present local expansion rate. The other one, I suppose, could be regarded as a more direct measurement, but it is using astrophysics to construct a sort of distance ladder. And Katie mentioned supernovae, but that's the final rung of the ladder. The ladder starts in the local universe, and it's basically the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is the closest small galaxy to us. That's the first rung. And you have to build the ladder using different kinds of stars, which are standard candles. So all of this requires quite a lot of modeling, and some of that modeling is cosmological. It's a cosmological model, but other aspects of it are not. So astronomers are very, very used to and need to very, very carefully understand their error budget. And just understanding it to the level that we can say there's a 5 sigma tension between those two probes is a tremendous accomplishment.
So, we're going to go somewhere else now, okay? So we've talked about cosmological tensions. I really liked this question, and I'm going to pick on Latham for this question. What if there aren't singularities at all?
That will be a sign, very likely, that general relativity is not right, because general relativity seems to predict, you know, either general relativity is wrong, or the matter content of the universe is different than what we think it is. Now, neither of those things would be terribly surprising. I think we do all think that general relativity is probably not exactly correct, especially when you get close to extreme situations like singularities. And it's far from clear that the matter content that we know of in the universe is the exact is everything there is. So it would be a big discovery. It would mean some new Nobel Prize winning physics had been discovered. But I wouldn't bet against it. That's for sure. However, I, for the record, I would bet that the Big Bang singularity is not a singularity.
How would we ever know if singularities really exist in the universe?
You mean escape to tell the conference about it?
Yeah.
Famously, you can find out according to GR, by jumping into the black hole but it's not that they're unobservable, but they're hard to report about. At least the ones that form in gravitational collapse. The Big Bang singularity is not cloaked from us by any horizon. So, if you had two competing theories of the early universe, one which predicted Big Bang singularity was real, and that was a really essential part of how that theory ended up making a bunch of successful predictions about the late universe, versus another competing theory that predicted that the Big Bang was resolved into a non-singular bounce, and that made that, you know, depending on which of those two theories, if one of those had phenomenal success in explaining some thing about the late universe, then I think it would give, you know, evidence in favor or against there being a singularity, but only provisional evidence until someone came up with an even better theory that didn't, you know, that contravened it. But as long as it was the reigning best explanation, your best explanation would say that there was a, if your best explanation of the world says that there's a singularity, then the most rational thing to do at that moment is to believe that there's a singularity until there's a better explanation that supersedes it. Yeah.
Okay. On a similar note, I'm going to toss this one to Jonathan. Can we ever hope to have a scientific theory of the initial conditions of the universe, or can we only ever test the laws governing time evolution?
Okay, I think that depends on exactly what you mean by scientifically test. It's probably very hard to completely disentangle some like complicated initial condition from some very finely tuned laws of physics that the follow. But you have to think about what your like prior is on the theories that you think are reasonable. And science doesn't work with certainty ever. The way we always do things is like, subset of possibilities we think we have, we'll do some measurements. Given that, we now shrink down what we think is possible. And so in the sense that, you know, if we don't think doing crazy, very ugly looking initial conditions and time evolutions is the right way to do science, then at some level, you know, if we pin down what we think the evolution equations are well enough, we can start to constrain. But of course, we'll never have certainty. And I think it also depends what you mean by the initial conditions. That almost requires you to have a statement about how are we going to resolve the Big Bang? Is there a singularity? Was there something before? If there was a singularity, what's the physical model for that? You could have, for example, false vacuum decay multiverse models. The Big Bang is like a bubble nucleation. So there was something beforehand, but are you ever going to be able to probe that? Probably not. But, okay, I guess is this also probably getting at the question of, do we have any examples in science of, like, inferring the initial conditions as a scientific theory? I don't know that that's true.
Okay, well, a related question. Katie, you wanted to comment on that.
The initial conditions of what exactly? Like any experiment or?
Oh, well, so if I'm like building an experiment, fine, I can be like, this is what I did. But then you have a theory of yourself making the experiment. Or if you're like, I'm in equilibrium, I can determine the states of equilibrium. But, you know, cosmology, for example, is not consistent with probably. So you have some other state that you're sitting in. For example, why is the entropy so low in the past? Yeah. Okay.
But I think it sounds like that's the kind of apple pie from scratch argument. Like, can we ever infer the initial conditions of anything? We have to know the initial conditions of the universe, and that's the question, right? Are there? Sorry, I'm just.
Yeah, I think yes. Okay. If you really wanted to be like, we're going to come up with a scientific theory for initial conditions, it's conditional on saying I knew what happened before. That gives me some prediction. That's the new initial conditions for the state that I'm now sitting. But then you need initial conditions for that state that you came out of. Right. You just pushed it, punted it down the road.
Right. Someplace.
Yeah. Okay. Can I add an observational perspective to this? I think it's an ill-defined question, as Jonathan was just saying, initial conditions of what, right? But we certainly have ruled out already dynamical theories for the initial conditions for structure formation by making measurements of the cosmic microwave background and, in particular, the non-Gaussian aspects of the cosmic microwave background. By constraining that very, very tightly, we've actually ruled out quite a lot of models already that are dynamical theories for generating the initial conditions for structure formation. So, I think we proceed by excluding mechanisms rather than proving one type of mechanism.
Yeah.
Let me pick up on this and toss a question to Latham that I'll ask you. I'll rephrase the question. Is the wave function of the universe a scientific theory of the initial conditions?
Yeah, so I was just going to say, I think that most of cosmology, for very understandable and good reasons, is concerned with the theory of how the universe evolves from T1 to T2. But it's a very, I think, a very, very interesting and understudied area of cosmology is finding a good theory of the initial conditions or of the wave function of the universe. I don't really see any particular reason that should be outside the realm of science or untestable. I mean, in particular, the most famous and, a beautiful pioneering suggestion about this was the Hartle-Hawking proposal for the wave function of the universe, which was just essentially the idea to try to take the path integral that we usually use to evolve from T1 to T2 seriously and regard it as not just a thing that gives you the conditional probability, but of B given A, but the absolute probability of B, and their hypothesis about how you would do that would be to, instead of taking the path integral between boundary one and boundary two, just take the path integral over configurations that only have boundary two and manage to not have any other boundary. So it's a really beautiful idea, but it's scientific because it really predicted the wrong answer and I think was ruled out, basically, or at least it needs a new idea. It doesn't mesh well with inflation, that's for sure. So yeah, I think it's scientific. I think more people should be working on it. And actually, I was going to say that, I was trying to brainstorm, given that this is a conference about simulating quantum simulators. I think various, normally a fact about wave function of the universe proposals is that often you can't really calculate their predictions. Like a beautiful idea, like the Hartle-Hawking proposal. It's very hard to really calculate what it predicts, and so you can only calculate in very special, highly symmetric, very simplified toy model contexts. And it would be really cool if you could somehow find ways of simulating different competing proposed models of the universe and see, do they when you actually simulate them in some appropriately analogous context, do they really tend to produce simulated universes that are nearly homogeneous and isotropic? Do they really predict the, is the little thing you nucleate, does it really have perturbate, correlations like the ones you see? That seems, it would be very cool if anyone could think of ways to do that. I mean, because a lot of these proposals have the flavor that they are basically trying to say that the universe, well, the Hartle-Hawking proposal certainly has the flavor that it was taking the mathematics that's normally used to describe nucleation of a bubble of true vacuum within a false vacuum and kind of slightly generalizing that to try to apply to the universe being regarded as a bubble of something nucleating either from nothing or from some background. And so that does sounds like the sort of thing that maybe if in the appropriate context you could make an artificial situation in the lab that would be, you know, maybe in lower dimensions but analogous, or you know, have you know, the nucleation would be described dominantly by some analogous instanton. Have you already done this, Matt? And I'm just
yeah,
kind of advertising your work.
False vacuum decay by doing experiments.
Yeah,
and that has a lot of the flavor of trying to understand better the connection between real time, hopefully quantum dynamics, and the instanton formalism, which is of a similar flavor as what's used to describe the no boundary proposal. In both cases, it's a path integral over field configurations. On the one hand, it's gravitational field configurations. When we're talking about the no boundary proposal versus field configurations when we're talking about false vacuum decay.
Right.
But yeah, that would be a challenge to the audience to try and simulate really simple contexts of like the Wheeler-DeWitt equation on a quantum simulator. That sounds amazing. Let's do it. Yeah.
Yeah, could you please elaborate on the no boundary proposal getting ruled out? What did you mean by that?
Well, so again, you calculate in some sort of it can only be computed in certain approximation schemes. But I guess maybe let's say there seems to be both a theoretical problem and then a kind of comparison with observation problem. The theoretical problem had to do with the fact that it was formulated in the context of Euclidean quantum gravity, which just wasn't bounded above or below, and so there was never. No one has yet come up with a great explanation for why the particular instanton that they propose is the dominant one in the path integral. But then, more observationally, I just mean that in the simple cases, in the sort of simple example cases. They wanted it to produce produce inflation, nucleate a universe that would then inflate and give the universe today. And so, for example, a simple example that they work out is the case of where the only matter in the universe is a single scalar field, because if you displace the field from the origin enough in a single scalar field with, like, for example, an m squared phi squared potential, it would roll down and inflate. But you know, in that universe, it predicts that the universe would nucleate very low on the potential and undergo a negligible amount of inflation. That's exponentially more probable than that it would nucleate 60 e folds up the potential and undergo the required 60 e folds of inflation. So it predicts, you know, it seems to naively predict the opposite of what you see. It predicts no inflation is far favored over inflation. However, then there was a subsequent, you know, then there was a kind of subsequent. Anyway, Hawking and collaborators would not agree with my characterization of it. I should say they had another interpretation that they gave later on, which was that, you know, you had to calculate not the probability of the universe per se, but the calculation. Given observer would see inflation in their past, and by convolving with some sort of measure for observers in the multiverse, that they claim to be able to solve the problem. And I personally did not find that resolution convincing. But that's maybe that's a more controversial point than I maybe stated it as. Yeah.
Yeah, it's somewhat of a combination of a comment and a question. But apart from the specifics of the no boundary proposal, my understanding of this idea is that the goal is to remove any possibility, I guess, that initial conditions in cosmology could be set by the user, the motivation being that unlike other systems in physics, it's everything we've got. And so I think the motivation or the idea is there is some logical physical principle that tells us what the initial conditions must be. And then one would work out the observational consequences of that. So I guess I'm asking anybody in the panel if A, they would agree with that as the idea, and B, if they find it objectionable in any way. I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm just curious what you...
I guess one thing you could imagine would be very compelling is you have... This is turning the initial conditions into dynamics, though, is to say, okay, this is my model for the universe, and you know, there's an attractor somewhere, and that attractor, everything will go there and then slowly peel off. And out of that, I get something consistent with all my observations. And so from the point of view of us looking back, that will look like an initial condition, but it's also turning it into something dynamical. So in the sense of like, you'd like a principle determining what you started with, I mean, I think that's fine, but it's also, how are you gonna decide that's the right principle? It's not necessarily an easy thing, short of having all kinds of observations. You know, like, why do we think that symmetry is the principle that governs particle physics? It's because it matched all the observations that came out of colliders. And it's not so clear how you can do that for, say, like, the initial conditions of the universe. We're going to get one crack at looking at it. Okay, did you happen to get lucky when you drew it? You know,
sure, but how is a different question than why? The why question is, should we bother at all? The how question is, if you think it's worth bothering with, how would you go about it? That's the distinction I would make.
Go for it, talk. Yeah.
I always found a very compelling argument that Hawking would describe was that, you know, normally we think we have this very good, very general principle for evolving from T1 to T2, the path integral, which is sort of one law of physics. But then, you know, a priori, it seems like you need a completely separate, new, so far undiscovered law of physics for the initial conditions. But wouldn't it be economical if there really was no second law number two, if it was just sort of taking seriously law number one and maybe slightly changing your perspective on it a little bit was enough to also get you the larger answer of what the initial conditions was. So that seems like a very beautiful economical idea to me, you know, and maybe it's right. And he just didn't quite have the right way of taking it more seriously or getting the unconditional probability from the conditional probability or something like that.
Yeah. But the interesting thing, I think, is the epistemic content of something like a no boundary proposal really any different than the epistemic content of just saying these are the initial conditions?
Okay, I'm going to hijack that.
But anyway, sorry, that's my comment.
Into the next question, very much related, thank you very much, which is, and I'll give this one to Hiranya, are any models of the early universe correct, and how would we tell?
I think we've learned that a lot of models are not correct. And I think that we don't know yet whether any are correct. And what we have learned is that, you know, even for models which are still compatible with the data, they require some degree of fine-tuning. And the better that our data have got, the less fine-tuned models have been ruled out, right? So I think we've actually ruled out quite a few, quite different theories of structure formation. The current best favored theory seems to feature some kind of a causal mechanism behind it. And we don't need actually a theory to say that. We can directly see that in the data. You know, there has to be some set of quite uncomfortable facts that such a theory has to satisfy. So I think that we don't know the answer to that. But we are going to be getting more and more data and probing the universe better and better. So throw those theories at us, and we will test them.
Which data sets are you most excited to see?
Can I be futuristic at this point?
Totally.
So I'm currently most excited by the next generation of gravitational wave experiments. So Cosmic Explorer and Einstein Telescope. And, you know, this is a field that basically got its first detection in 2015 and already has rapidly gone into a very data-driven regime. And unlike many other types of experiments we can do to observe the universe, Usually you have to improve the signal to noise that's achievable by your experiment orders of magnitude before you see anything new. But just improving the signal to noise achievable by gravitational wave detectors by one order of magnitude, we can now, you know, we will be able to see sources across the entire universe up to a redshift of 100. And our theoretical models are not keeping track. Like, the observations will be better, faster than our theories, and our modeling will improve. And this is going to be the case in the next 10 to 15 years. It's coming really fast, and I'm very, very excited by that.
And pulsar timing arrays as well are another, I mean, maybe not the same kind of next generation of gravitational wave experiments, but experiments that are happening now to measure gravitational waves that might also find some really interesting, like, stochastic backgrounds and also could add to our understanding in a really cool way.
Okay. Katie, maybe I'll pick on you for this one. Do we need a theory of quantum gravity to understand the early universe?
I mean, it. how much do we want to understand?
Your choice. You can address this question however you wish.
I mean, if we have anything that looks remotely like a singularity, then yes. Beyond that, I guess that's a model dependent statement. How far back we want to go and what we think is happening there, but. Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to avoid that. Yeah, there are kind of only a couple of places where it seems like quantum gravity is really necessary, and one is black holes, and the other is almost certainly the early universe. Any other comments on that?
I'll make a slightly controversial statement. We already need a theory of quantum gravity to do inflation. It's just linearized quantum gravity. So the question is, do you need the nonlinear theory? And that is okay. That's dependent on what the initial conditions looked like way, 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 way in the past. But, you know, our current understanding of the early universe requires some aspects of quantum gravity because the gauge conditions are quantized along with the field. So,
okay. What about for models that involve a non-singular bounce? Do we need a theory of quantum gravity? Anyone want to take that? Nope.
Maybe just to say, you know, so I, in terms of whether we need a theory of quantum gravity to explain a non-singular bounce, you know, I read this book I loved, David Deutsch's second book, I don't know, The Beginning of Infinity, which had a big influence on my thinking about these things. But anyway, so, it, you know, roughly speaking, he's just talking, the idea in short is, sounds very mundane, that, you know, science is about, you know, at a given point, you have a best explanation for some set of facts you know about the universe. And ideas, and then name of the game is to find a better explanation, and then whatever is the best explanation at the moment, you know, that's your most rational way of assessing what you should and should not expect from the world, and what you should do going forward. And so, you know, I would say at the moment that our best explanation of the early universe does not involve a bounce. So. You know, I don't spend too much time wondering about whether we need quantum gravity in such models. I must say that my own unorthodox view is that inflation also does not give the best, most rational explanation of what we observe about the early universe. But anyway, so that's a separate story. Yeah.
Okay. I'll toss this to anyone who wants to answer it. It's very related. Does the panel agree there is no such thing as a true singularity, only in our effective theories? It's a great question, please.
Well, so, you know, I think that's another interesting thing in relation to this question about whether it's possible to simulate the early universe or the Big Bang in some way, that, you know, the way we all learn GR is formulated in terms of the metric tensor, et cetera, which is the notion of differential geometry that Einstein had available to him when he was originally formulating GR. But then about 10 years later, you know, Cartan came along and gave this more modern formulation of differential geometry, which is more what mathematicians think about today. And there's an equivalent, classically equivalent formulation of GR in terms of that, in terms of the spin connection one form and the tetrad one forms. And, you know, which I regard as a kind of deeper formulation of GR. And so black holes are one thing, but in terms of the Big Bang, you know, one striking thing there is that in that formulation, you know, there's really two bundles over space-time that are relevant. There's the tangent bundle in which particle momenta, et cetera, live, and which you, as you move across the manifold that you're moving in there. But then there's a separate bundle in where the tetrads live and where spinners live, which is the Lorentz the SO3,1 frame bundle where anyway, you need to include this to couple spinners to GR, and we know the world has spinners, and so there's something a little bit more right about this formulation. But in that way of looking at it, you know, the metric really lives in this SO3,1 bundle. It never becomes it's a constant. It never becomes singular, and the tetrad, which is the thing which gives the metric, which we relates that intrinsic metric to the one that we usually say becomes singular at the Big Bang, that's really a so-called soldering form that is just the kind of map between these two bundles. And that can become singular. That seems to be what becomes singular at the Big Bang. But that can become singular, and still both bundles can be completely smooth. It's just if they're topologically different, topology will force that thing to become singular somewhere. And so I don't know. So it just looks to me like in that way of looking at GR, that first of all, singularities could be real in the sense that if you have two different bundles over a manifold and they're smooth and they're wrapped in two topologically distinct ways, any map between them is just going to have singularities. But that singularity seems a lot less scary when it's not the universe shrinking to zero size, but it's some sort of map between two bundles just having to become singular at some point. And it all kind of smells a little bit related to the fact that's been emphasized by Penrose for decades now, which is that if you just take the observations of the early universe seriously, it looks a lot like what the early universe is telling us, is that the further back we look to the Big Bang, the simpler things get. And for some reason, the Big Bang was very ultra simple, so very different than the sort of singularity, the complicated sort of mess that you get at the center of a black hole during gravitational collapse, which almost certainly does require quantum gravity. It seems to be some very special, remarkably simple thing.
Okay, awesome. Awesome segue into another question, which maybe I'll toss to Hrania. So
there's a question.
Can I quickly chime in very quickly about that last point? If, as you were interpreting this, the singularity at the Big Bang is this singularity in the transformation between, or the connection between these bundles, can I still think of that as an intrinsic or a necessary singularity if, in a quantum picture of those structures, there is no longer a singular? So, for instance, if I have a quantum theory of those structures, that transformation is well-defined and non-singular at the quantum level, is that still an intrinsic singularity at the Big Bang? Or would that be a way of saying, oh, okay, in that way, it's not even a real singularity. I just wasn't putting a complicated enough picture into that description.
Good question. I don't really, it's sort of a thing that I'm sort of interested to think through more fully. But the quantum implications of that picture. But to some extent. But anyway, the basic answer is that I don't know. It just seems less scary to me in that way of looking at it. And so maybe.
Okay.
Thank you.
To pick up on the last point, though, one of the questions was, in parentheses, why did the universe start with a tiny entropy?
I'm not sure why you tossed this to me.
So
I don't think I have
is,
any new insight to this.
Do you think the
this.
Universe started in a state of tiny entropy?
That is what it seems to imply if we think that that's where the arrow of time came from. I'm going to toss this to Katie.
Can I toss it to Latham?
No, Latham just talked. No, that's not allowed. The universe started in a special state of low entropy?
I mean, that seems consistent with our understanding of the current entropy of the universe and the second law of thermodynamics, and like it seems like it's hard to escape the idea that the early universe had a low entropy. I think that's one of the things that kind of keeps me up at night about early universe theories is that we don't have a good explanation of that in our kind of standard inflationary picture, and that's one of the reasons I think that it's so useful to look at alternative early universe theories. I think that's one of that's one of the questions, along with like, why is the cosmological constant what it is, that I think that like we, if we really want to understand the fundamental nature of the universe, we have to answer those questions, and they're it's really hard to find a handle on those questions in our current framework. My answer is I don't know. It looks that way, but I think we need a lot more insight into why that is.
Just to pick up on the question about whether the universe is special in some way. I mean, earlier we had a long discussion about whether there's some deterministic way to, one way to determine the initial conditions of the universe. But increasingly, all we know about particle physics and fundamental physics seems to be telling us actually that there are many, many possibilities that the universe could have been in. And yet, it looks like the universe we have now, which is very, very kind of almost fine-tuned for life. And that brings up this very uncomfortable discussions about the anthropic principle. But from another perspective, like, you know, for example, thinking about evolution, right? You know, you can get, you know, development of certain properties just by accident and interaction with the environment. And I personally don't have a particularly shocking reaction to thinking that, you know, we are in one of many, many possible types of universes. I just don't have any problem with that. So in that sense, the initial conditions are not special. They're just one of the possibilities, and it's the one that we happen to be in. And in that kind of universe, there is a low entropy initial state that happened to be the case, and then there's, you know, an interesting amount of matter to cause interesting dynamics and allow life to develop and have an arrow of time.
I somehow find that viscerally terrifying.
I have a question. Penrose believes if we add gravity, we start from a higher entropy toward lower entropy. Why it is the case from his point of view?
I didn't quite catch.
So we would never start from a high entropy and go to low entropy, because then we'd all be Boltzmann brains, yeah?
Yeah.
So we'd be the lowest possible deviation from the maximal state of entropy possible, and then we would have materialized after a long process of assembly, become sentient, intelligent beings for the next 5 minutes, and then we will dematerialize slowly back into the vacuum. So you'll find out in 5 minutes.
Do you want me to comment on Boltzmann brains?
Oh yeah, please. But also there's a question related to it. You can comment on Boltzmann brains, but then you can answer the question, can we ever learn about the multiverse if it exists?
Okay. I'll talk about, maybe you wrote a book about this, so maybe you should talk about the long-term future of the universe and the fact that we are just a blip in the expected history of the universe.
Is this the Boltzmann brain thing that we're... Yeah, well...
You're much more likely to be Boltzmann brains than human beings.
Well, I mean, I think that's it's a really interesting argument, the Boltzmann brain question. I mean, I think that what it tells us is much more that we don't have a good framework for understanding these probabilities, and we don't have a good framework for kind of, calculating the statistical mechanics of random fluctuations in a sort of long-lived universe, but this comes back to what my reaction to your statement about it being terrifying, the idea that all of physics is an accident, and I mean I understand that it might be that there are some properties of you know the universe we live in that are just accidents, that are just you know, there's a large universe and we happen to live in one part of it, but it's upsetting to me that the origin of the universe might not be something that will tell us something deep about the nature of reality and the way it kind of has to be. If there's nothing meaningful about our initial conditions, or there's nothing meaningful about the sort of early evolution of the universe in terms of understanding, you know, how everything came together and where it's all going and so on, I find that sort of a very sort of depressing idea, more depressing than the fact that the universe is going to die one way or another.
I think it's quite meaningful to learn that the universe is probabilistic in its nature rather than deterministic. I don't see why that is meaningless.
No, it's not. I mean, I'm okay with the idea that the universe is probabilistic, but the idea that there is no basis for the you know how we came to be, that it's just, you know, we just happen to live in a universe with these properties. There's another universe with another set of properties. There's this whole multiverse where nothing matters, and we just kind of show up in the place where we can show up. I find that sad. not that it's not true, but I think it would be. I would rather find that there is some, you know, deep meaningful structure behind all of the laws of physics.
Let me again give the biological perspective. Life, the evolution of life, seems to be a series of accidents, and it's rich and beautiful and worth celebrating.
No, it is, and I'm not saying that that's not true, but.
Okay, we can go back to the multiverse.
Okay. Give a slightly different perspective.
Okay. Yeah, go for it.
Sure. Related to the entropy as well. I mean, it's like locally, it looks like entropy is small. We don't know globally. We don't know how big the universe is. We suck at computing probabilities in infinitely large things and in time. But it could be that, you know, having in it, so suppose we take this multiverse perspective and we're just like a random fluctuation, basically there's some like evolution going on in the laws of physics. That's already a very interesting physical system, even if it's not like locally we know everything. It's like, no, we're a particular realization of some more complex system.
But I want to know the properties of that more complex system too. Right?
That would be ideal. I guess that's one way. Maybe not testable, but a way to try and test the multiverse is like, here's my model, and now the standard model is some particular values I can test. And maybe that's correlated with the value of the cosmological constant that we have locally, and correlated with, oh, inflation happened, and we had to start with this much energy density trapped in some condensate. You know, I think the way that you would have to go after these things is have a model that correlates different properties that can be measured.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And then hope that within your model, those correlations are actually the things that we see realized.
Yeah, I hope we're not reduced to just calculating probabilities on the landscape based on, you know, sort of wild conjectures about the number of observers you would get in certain kinds of universes, because that's a very unsatisfying direction to go.
I think we all agree about that.
Okay.
Well, I'll just say on Matt's behalf. So I guess if there was a multiverse, in response to the original question, is it testable? Matt and Haranya also. Did you guys, one way to observe it would be if different bubbles in the multiverse collided with one another, and there would be observational signatures of that. But you looked and there weren't, and so far there's no. We shouldn't talk about it like it's a done deal. So it's there's no evidence for it yet. So
pretty done deal.
Yeah. Or, I mean, done in that sense. No, I mean, I just mean, yeah, you put nice tight bounds on it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But didn't find evidence for it.
Yeah, there was a nice possibility for potentially testing it. And sadly, the universe did not oblige.
Actually, could I ask about that? And so you talk about that like the story is over. Is there no prospect for future better tests because it's mainly on large scales? Is that the idea? Or?
So we thought that getting polarization data would help us tighten the signal-to-noise constraints. And after having done simulations in numerical relativity to predict that signature really well, and simulated cosmic variance limited polarization data, it doesn't actually really improve much over our original constraints just with CMB temperature. So sadly, not. It was something like a 15% improvement, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, you need something really future. You can do better in principle, but you need a 3D map of the universe on the largest scales, which I could sell you a way to do that, but maybe in 30 years. In 30 years, I bet you can improve our constraints by an order of magnitude by looking at the cross-correlation between mega big galaxy surveys like LSST, and if we ever build a 30-meter dish with a megapixel CMB camera called CMB High Definition, then maybe.
Say again, you'd improve it by how much?
An order of magnitude.
Uh-huh. In terms of the size of the bubbles you could look for, in terms of the likelihood of...
The likelihood of forming them.
Okay.
Which is kind of a piddly thing, because as we've learned in the conference, bubbles nucleate exponentially rarely. So if you improve an order of magnitude on an exponential, then in the exponent, it's really not that impressive.
Right.
So someday there will be a not that impressive improvement. Or we'll find it, optimistically. Speaking of finding things and learning new things, one of the questions is... and I'm going to kind of slightly reinterpret this question, and I'll throw it at Jonathan. What would we really like to learn by simulating cosmic inflation or other early universe scenarios with atomic BECs?
Okay. What do I think we would really like to learn? So as I said before, you know, early universe is already a quantum theory. And the way we think the early universe looked was that a lot of the interesting features are very, very non-equilibrium and non-linear. Like, inflation is a non-equilibrium phenomenon. And it's coupled to gravity. We won't be doing that with BECs anytime soon. But we don't really, we can't from first principles be like, here's my quantum field theory, I'm going to compute it. We don't actually know how to do this, except in some very limited perturbative circumstances. And so we have to approximate things, okay? And all of our understanding of what's going on when things like phase transitions happen, when inflation ends, strings are forming, monopoles are forming, whatever, is all based on making approximations to quantum field theory. And we don't know if these are correct, okay? And even assessing, like, here's another calculational tool I can use is, like, very, very difficult. So the only way you can test your theoretical approaches is to, like, build an experiment, okay? And the nice thing about analog experiments is it's like, this is a quantum field. Well, okay, it's a mini-body system. If I go to long wavelengths, it's a quantum field, okay? I don't have to approximate how do I do quantum mechanics with millions of particles. It's just there. And now you can say, well, here's the approach I'm trying to use for cosmology. There's sort of like a few basic assumptions that go in. I'm going to make the same basic assumptions to simulate a BEC or something like that. With the BEC experiment, does that framework match what I actually observe? And if it does, it's giving you a lot more confidence in the theoretical tools that you're using in early universe, because we're not going to build a universe in the lab, presumably. Maybe in the future, not in my lifetime, I don't think. So it's really like, can we verify our tools, which will really give us a lot more confidence that we understand what we're doing. And also, you know, we don't have like a theory of the early universe. No one can write down a Lagrangian. Everything we have is like phenomenological models. So really all you're trying to do is be like, we have these sorts of sets of behavior that we think can happen. Do we really understand them? And in this sense, like, you don't need to completely reproduce, oh, this is the right model for inflation, everything's there. I mean, we just need to get some aspects that we don't understand and confirm that, yeah, in a real experiment, it matches what I think I should be doing. I now am much happier about the way that I'm doing my cosmological simulations.
Wonderful. So we have 5 minutes left, and I thought we would try and end this. You've been answering questions, but I would like you each to formulate what you believe your favorite or what you think the most important question you have in theoretical cosmology is. Okay. Give you 2 seconds to think. Katie, you're first.
the most important question in theoretical
cosmology. Or your favorite.
Oh, gosh.
And go if you like.
Okay, yeah, you go first.
I want to know the solution to the cosmological constant problem, because this is a known problem. We have now verified that the universe probably looks like a cosmological constant with a very low unexplainable value. And it seems like the theoretical community is very happy to turn their heads away from that or invoke the anthropic principle or talk about modified gravity while setting the cosmological constant problem to zero, you know? And this doesn't make sense to me. I think this is the biggest problem in theoretical physics, and I would like to see a renewed effort in it.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. As I said before, it's one of the things that keeps me up at night. I guess I'll go with the other thing that keeps me up at night, which is the origin of the universe. It's just does it start from a low entropy state? Is there a singularity? Like, did inflation actually happen? And if so, how and why? Those are the kinds of I think those are the kinds of questions that I'm most sort of eager to know.
Jonathan?
The easy one got taken, so I'll do something more outrageous. If we think the fluctuations were quantum, inflationary, why do they look so classical now? Like, how do you actually go from a quantum universe into a classical one? And how does that transition actually work in detail, including nonlinearity and everything? Okay.
Okay, Latham.
Okay, maybe the wave function of the universe, but could I take my 2 minutes to instead say a problem that I hope that the simulators will simulate?
Yeah, challenge them.
Okay, so I think a cool thing would be that, the Big Bang, as we were discussing earlier, there's different perspectives on what it's all about, but anyway, just like, in GR, just like you can describe things in different coordinate systems, you can describe things in different conformal frames, and it seems very interesting. It always seemed very interesting to me that, if you go into the conformal frame where just as a matter of a change of variables, you can go into the conformal frame where the space is not expanding, is just static. But then the price you pay is that in that conformal frame, the masses of particles are changing in time, and in particular, the fermions have masses that are going to zero and then are decreasing, and then they go to zero at the Big Bang, and then they become negative on the other side, which is fine for a fermion. Like if a fermion had a constant mass that was positive, or a fermion had a constant mass that was negative, that would just be a matter of a change of variables. It's physically perfectly fine. It's just a matter of convention. But if you have a time-varying mass that changes from positive to negative as you pass through the Big Bang, well, that's something interesting going on that you could ask if there's something, some special physics that happens at the moment where the mass passes through zero. And there's this very close analogy in the spatial direction that has been very fruitful in condensed matter physics for the past 10 or 15 years, which are these topological insulators that people basically realize that if fermions have their mass go from positive to negative as you cross some spatial boundary between two different phases of matter, the vacuum outside and a topological insulator or a topological superconductor, that you get interesting physics, degrees of freedom confined to the boundary, the interface where the mass passes through zero. So you get, in that case, for example, you usually get different sorts of chiral massless fermions that are sort of confined and living on the boundary. It just seems very interesting to try to make some sort of analog system in the lab where the effective mass particles in your system pass through zero, fermions in the system have an effective mass that passes from negative to positive, and then ask what happens at the sort of interface boundary, which is now a boundary in time, not in space. That would be, seems like a simulatable thing that I've always been interested to hear what would happen.
Cool. Latham will be here after the session, which I will thank you all now for attending. So let's give our panelists a hand.